Before I worked with him, Norman had established a standard for an oil company's gasoline filling stations. I believe he was the first one to come up with smooth, easily clean exteriors and interiors, and advocated the idea of studying the site and being able to adapt prefabricated structures to that particular gasoline filling station. Before that, there was no standard. A filling station might be a shack on the side of the road, or it might be a very fancy place shaped like an airplane or a radio or something, but he standardized this, and I'm sure the whole industry picked up from his original idea. That was his approach typically. He would study the whole problem. He'd want to find out what people wanted, how they would enter a gas station, and so forth and so on.
This was a clean, rectilinear approach to service station architecture.
Right.
Nothing like the Sinclair or the standard of that era. Standard Oil, which went in for fancy architecture and roof, crenellated roof.
That's right. The approach was somewhat similar to his designs of the early stoves, mm-hmm. that were easily cleaned. I might say, incidentally, that these gasoline station buildings were, when they started, were quite outstanding. They mm-hmm. they stood out from in the neighborhood, and They did make people want to go in there because they would have clean restrooms and
right.
so forth.
Did this major oil company utilize this Belgetti's design nationwide for its complete chain?
Oh, I believe they did. Mm-hmm. I believe they did. And as I said before, the other companies more or less had to mm-hmm. to do about the same type of thing. And it's pretty much still done today, as far as I know.
So in effect, it was a revolutionary approach to
yeah.
Service station architecture.
Right. Oh, definitely. But as I say, he got into the whole story, not just one little local place.
Mm-hmm. Have any of these survived? Have you ever seen them?
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty of them still around.
Do you run across them occasionally in your travels?
I don't identify them,
uh-huh.
but it became such a common thing to see
almost
that I think I still see them today mm-hmm. without paying much attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether it was Texaco. I somehow don't think it was, but when I was with Norman, I designed the Texaco Sky Chief emblem for Norman. He assigned me to do this. He wanted some ideas, and this is a good lesson for young designers. I was a young designer then. I went to my desk and I spent 2 days. I think I used, about 3 pads of tracing paper just sketching ideas. I sketched a hell of a lot of them. And I took them down to Norman, and he took one look at the bunch and threw them on the floor. And he said something like, "Who the hell do you think I am?" He said, "You take those back and pick out 5 of them and bring them to me." He wasn't going to spend hours trying to make a selection, and obviously I couldn't. I'd been so engaged, you know, in coming up with a whole lot of ideas, but
Texaco has kept that emblem for many years.
Yeah, he had me make some rather larger paintings or renderings mm-hmm. of, I think, 3 different designs. It might have been 5. This was a long time ago. And when I showed them to him, he said, "I tell you what I want you to do." He said, "Take them up to so-and-so, who was the vice president of Texaco."
Mm-hmm.
And so-and-so had an office, I think it was near the top of the Chrysler building. Pretty sure it was Chrysler building because that was the second tallest building in the world then,
mm-hmm.
with a marvelous view, you know, over the East River and so forth. And he was a pretty big man in the company. But Norman was a bold and a wily character. He said, "You take these up to so-and-so's office, and I want you to listen to what comments he makes so we can find out what he wants." He said, "I can't have anybody else do it because they wouldn't know what he was talking about." And I said, "Okay." And Norman said, he's going to ask you who you are, and you tell him you're the office boy, you're just delivering them and waiting that Norman wants them back right away. That's so he won't be influenced in what he says. So I took him up. I went through about three secretaries, and I got into his office, and he had me line him up on the wall, you know, and I stood there looking at the beautiful view while he looked at him and called some people in, and he started making comments about which one he liked and which he thought was awful and so forth. And all of a sudden he swung around and he said, "And who are you?" And I said, I'm the office boy. I'm just delivering these." And he turned away, and then he kind of gave me a sharp look, looked over his shoulder, and he said, "The hell you are." He said, "I know who you are. You're the guy that designed these for that bastard, and you take them back and tell him thus and so."
And didn't he like them?
I don't know if that was his exact language.
Didn't he like them?
Yeah, he liked them. Mm-hmm. But he, now what did he, oh, and he said, "Okay, now, which one do you like? You made these." He was not a dumb person. And I think he had probably seen me around or something when he had been visiting Norman. But he got me to criticize them myself. You know, which one did I like and why? What was the reason for doing this and that? So I took him back with his message in mind and took him up to Norman. Norman wanted to know what he said. And of course I had to explain to him that the guy got on to Norman's little subterfuge. And Norman said, "What did you say?" And I said, "Well, I told him this and that and the other thing." And again, I got some rather nasty words and was fired.
Oh.
Wasn't the first time.
Not for not following instructions?
Well, for assuming Norman's post. Hmm. He said, "Whose business is this? You're telling my client," you know. It was a good lesson, very good lesson.
Yeah.
Because many younger people will be working for other people, and they, when you're young, sometimes you don't think before you speak. But he
was adamant you were out.
Yeah, he said, "You're fired." He was really, really ticked off, and I went upstairs and gathered my stuff up. It took me a half an hour, and came down, and his office was in a sort of a living room in a bay in the ground floor in an old brownstone like that, usually about 10 feet above the sidewalk. And there were big sliding doors to this old living room. And he, you know, when he saw me really going out with all my tools, he said, "Where are you going?" You know, and then, you know, went through the now bit, you know, and you've learned a lesson, and I have.
So he'd reconsider.
Yeah, but he, I can't remember the other reasons, but I think he fired me about three times. And I eventually surprised him by coming down and announcing I was quitting. I had made contact with Chrysler. I had met my future wife out in Detroit, and I wanted to move. And I felt at the time that when the World's Fair was over with, there wouldn't be any more designing. There'd be a scarcity of design projects in the New York City area. It was a good time to get out. So anyway, I told Norman I was leaving, and he couldn't convince me to stay. So he, as I actually walked away from him, he said, "When you go upstairs, tell Miss So-and-so to get in contact with some man I don't know." And he, you know, he named a name and named it a couple of times, and it was all right with me. I'd tell the secretary. And but he added, "He's the man I'm replacing you with." You know, he was letting me know that I could be replaced.
Back to the Texaco Star, was that adapted as their trademark symbol?
Yeah, they used that. They used that for many years.
Did they?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now they paid Bell Geddes for the commission, but
oh, certainly, I was an employee.
You were yeah. A salaried employee. Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah.
So up till now, no one but you and I, and now your listeners know that you were the person who designed the famous Texaco Star.
Yeah, and I can claim no fame for it, because as I told you before, I had sketched a zillion designs, and it was just one that they and he too thought would be a thing that people would remember.
That's the one that the Sinclair executive chose.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Whoever he was, to me he was a Texaco vice president.
Before you leave Bill Geddes. Were there others, other commissions that you had, the other commissions he had, which he assigned you, that your basic design was...
Yeah, I'll have to look...
utilized?
Gosh, I hope I can find something. Yeah, there were other things that we were doing.
But that are still in effect today, perhaps?
I don't know. At that time, I was doing freelancing, too.
Mm-hmm.
I did a display for one of the first electric shavers. I did a display for them at the World's Fair.
Was that Schick?
I don't remember. I'm not sure. I just don't remember. But I did some minor things. For example, a very good family friend was putting on a display in the Midway at the fair.
Mm-hmm.
It was, the title of it was magazine covers. He did a couple of, they looked like great big Saturday Evening Post covers,
mm-hmm.
and he had these models come out in very skimpy clothing.
Mm-hmm.
This was Jack Sheridan, and Jack specialized in, he liked photography. My father disdained the way Jack did his illustrations because Jack would take photographs first, and sometimes he'd utilize colored lighting. And anyway, he'd have these girls come out and pose, you know, hold still,
mm-hmm.
and he would light them with warm lighting from one side and cold on another, and he would encourage people to take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
He charged them to come in. This was part of the what would we call it, the pleasure end of the World's Fair, the Great White Way.
The Midway.
The Midway.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack had a banker that, you know, banked him on this thing. He had one girl come out from and pose for as if she was part of a magazine cover, which Jack did, and my dad did, but Jack did many more. And then when she'd go away, another one would be in the other side. And I did some of the lettering and stuff like that for him. Norman, now I'm getting away from transportation, but Norman did his banker went along with him. He did a show in the Midway. It was quite a terrific thing. One-way mirrors had come in then, and he got a glass company to cooperate with him in this thing. You, as a customer, you went to the ticket office, bought your ticket, and went in, and you you could climb up to three balconies that went around the interior of this building. Now the building was, I don't know, 4 or 5 stories high, square-looking thing. But inside, it was all see-through mirrors in the form of a giant octagon. It had 8 sides, no matter which way you took a section. And in the middle of the bottom, there was a raised, what would you call it, a dais?
Dais.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Which was only 4 or 5 feet square, had a trap door in it, and it and its sloping sides were all mirror too.
Mm-hmm.
And this girl would come up through the trap door, and she would only be wearing a little piece of gauze.
Mm-hmm.
She had her more vulnerable parts taped up with flesh-colored tape so she would meet the city laws.
Mm-hmm.
But she'd come up and do a dance of the single veil or whatever it was, and then go exit through the trapdoor, and you would see thousands of reflections
mm-hmm.
of her
mm-hmm.
Because you'd be behind these mirrors, and yet you wouldn't see anybody else on the other side and also on a balcony.
This was a Bill Geddes concept.
It was a Bill Geddes concept.
They're very imaginative.
Yeah, he really was, but he didn't know what to call it. And so I got the assignment, think of a name. So I worked on this for quite a while, and I came up with the name. Again, I was promised extra salary, and a suit of clothes. And I've heard this story in the automobile companies too, you know, mm-hmm. buy a suit of clothes, Gil. Yeah. And I don't know where that comes from, but I'm trying to think of the name. It sounded, the name was Crystal Lassies. And of course you could take that either way. he and his backer just thought that was great. That was the name. They made the signs for it. And I'm talking about, you know, big signs, mm-hmm. lighted and so forth. And rather the last minute, why the New York City Commission decided that they wouldn't allow it. The name had to be taken down, and just before the fair opened, we came up with some rather mundane name. I don't remember what it was, but I thought that was a real good name. And I also enjoyed going out there to make sure the sign was done right and put up right and so forth, and later taken down, because I could sit around a little dressing room underneath there and talk to the girls, mm-hmm. and the girls weren't wearing anything. They were quite something. Yeah. We, can I tell you a little more about Belgetti's anecdote? When the agents for these girls would bring them to Norman for their audition, Norman, we would know this was coming up because usually the financial man would come down also, and they would audition in Norman's office. But the girls would be sent into, he had his own lounge room with a couch and so forth in there, and the girls would dress in there. And we would see these obvious Broadway-type men come in with a very good-looking girl with a lot of mascara on and sit and wait in the outer waiting room. And the joke was that you'd tell somebody else, Norman wants you in his office right away. And you'd take a shortcut through the drafting room and through through the lounge, and here this girl, maybe three of them, would be undressing. Mm-hmm. And it seems odd, but it's something I don't understand. They didn't mind being seen by thousands of people with nothing on but dressing or undressing in their undies or whatever. Mm-hmm. They would scream and cover up and mm-hmm. yell, and you'd get red in the face and run out of there. It was kind of a joke. But I was called to go through there one afternoon, and I went hustling in to see Norman, and there was a beautiful girl laying on the couch with her kind of hip bone sticking up and everything, and I realized I'd been joked. And ran out of there, and it was Barbara, who is still an actress. She plays the parts of mothers or grandmothers now, but she was a 17-year-old girl at the time.
It was Barbara Belgetti's.
Barbara Belgetti's.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get to meet her again?
No, never did. But I did have the opportunity of printing a contract that Norman had me draw up for Barbara's allowance. He was a stickler. He was going to keep her on the proper allowance, and again he corrected all the small type for this. And there was only going to be three or four of them printed, you know. But we had to do it right. And I don't remember the provisions right now, but she was going to a college or a finishing school out of town, and he was limiting her to. She could only spend so much money at different department stores and only so much total per month. She wanted a grand piano in her room. So this was completely above her limitations. She bought the piano in parts from different stores. She charged it to, I think, 2 different months or 3 months. And she had this thing done, and he was just furious. But she pulled a typical Norman Belgetti's trick on him. Mm-hmm. She was a. I personally didn't witness all of this, but I had to print the contract, and people told me later about it that they were getting a big laugh out of it, that she had pulled a Belgetti's on Belgetti's.
Well, he was a remarkable person. Anyway.
Yeah, he really was. Oh, I was going to tell you about the, I'll make it short. We printed these announcements, or started to, and I had a man running the printing press in this little closet-like room in our new quarters in the in Radio City. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, the rollers, which were made out of glue, they were glue rollers in those days, melted. And the glue just ran up and down the platen, down, it was like pouring glue into a typewriter, down into the machinery. Someone had turned the air conditioning off, and we didn't realize it. We're just sweating away there. And I had to run downtown. That was a Saturday night. Sunday morning, I was running around downtown trying to find a printer who would print these things for me by deadline. And I had gotten an address at some place, and I went into a big printing place. They had, you know, they had two-story high printing presses in there, the real things. Mm-hmm. And they took my job, re-photographed it, printed it, and ran it off, and I got a bill from them. And I hung around there, and I realized later that they were running secretly. The people that owned the press didn't know it. In fact, they had lookouts outside watching out for union representatives, because they were running their own job.
Oh, I see.
On the boss's presses.
Uh-huh.
And they were doing it secretly from the union, too. Well, the owner of the printing company found out about it and sent Norman a big bill. And of course, Norman was furious. He had no sympathy with me. I got his job out in time, and that was another time he fired me. But I better finish with Norman. So I will. Do you want to take another break? Okay. So as I think I started to mention some time ago, I quit Bell Geddes. I wanted to go back to Detroit. I had met my future wife back there. I wanted to be with her. I thought automobile design was quite fascinating. It was something to conquer, and I chiefly felt that demand for a designer in the New York area at the end of the New York World's Fair would be very low. In other words, I wanted to assure myself of of good employment. So I started spending my spare time again making renderings of automobiles. This time I concentrated on their front ends, and I thought I was quite clever. I took photographs of existing automobiles, just their front ends, and I made very colorful illustrations of how I would facelift, how I would change that, utilizing the same sheet metal they had. And I sent them out to Chrysler. I had been at General Motors, so I was left with Ford or Chrysler. I had had an unfortunate time getting employment with Ford before, so I had put them out of my mind, and Chrysler was left.
You had approached Ford?
I had approached Ford when I left General Motors.
I see. What happened?
I had an appointment with, was Bob Gregory the man who ran?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, Bob.
I had an appointment with Bob Gregory. Now, he'd never heard of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure years later he'd never heard of me either. But I had a letter from somebody. And I had gone out there on some dark, gloomy day in March. And I had approached the employment office, which was on an overpass or something,
mm-hmm.
on the edge of the Rouge.
Yes.
And when I stopped my car, I had already noticed a couple of rather sinister-looking men lurking in the doorways out of the wind, with their fedoras pulled down. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I stopped and got out, why, they came, I'll say, scurrying over to me and threatened me.
You know, wanted you to move.
Well, I said, oh, well, I'm supposed to go in the employment office. I have a letter here. Yeah. And it was, you know, get the hell out of here, Buster, and mm-hmm. that type of thing.
What year was that?
That would be 1938.
Okay.
I think they were the goon types I've read about since then.
Harry Benton's servicemen.
Yeah.
Service.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, there were three or four of them. Three of them, I think. Mm-hmm. And they were really menacing,
mm-hmm.
and I got out, and I remember circling around and coming back and going by there because I wanted to make sure that it was the right place, and it was. It was the place I was supposed to come to. And so I never continued it any further. I thought, well, I've heard some bad things about Detroit. I'm going to get out of here and go back to New York. And that's when I went back.
The Battle of the Overpass occurred almost that spot.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, mm-hmm. Yeah. But at any rate, when I told Norman I was going to leave him, I had been out to Detroit already. As a matter of fact, I would go out on weekends. Mm-hmm. I'd take the Detroiter, the train.
Yes.
I'd get on it Friday night and have dinner and do my homework, which I always had, and someplace west of Albany, I'd hit the sack.
Mm-hmm.
And
overnight run.
Yeah, I'd spend the weekend at my girl's house, at her parents' house. Mm-hmm. And
where they live?
They lived in Detroit on Ohio mm-hmm. Avenue,
okay.
Which is, of course, quite a different neighborhood now.
Mm-hmm.
But Sunday night, they'd take me down to the train, and I'd do it all in reverse, and I'd be shaving going, down the Hudson. And I'd get out at Grand Central Station, and Norman's office originally was just a couple of blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been out there a few times. And
50 Rockefeller Plaza?
Well, that was his second office when I was with him.
Where was his first office again?
The first office was on, I believe it was 37th Street off of Park Avenue, west of Park. Yeah, that's right, because...
You're in a brownstone.
In a brownstone on the south side of the street. You'd, because you'd come down and look around the corner and you'd see where Park Avenue went up and split and went around Grand Central.
Mm-hmm. Right.
At any rate, I submitted my these illustrations. There weren't very many of them, about four. I'm trying to think of his name.
Virgil Exner?
No. See if it'll come. Excuse the pause. On one of these weekend trips to the Detroit area, I had made contact with Bob Cadwalder at Chrysler and submitted these illustrations.
C-A-D.
C-A-D-W-A-L-L-E-D-E-R. It might have been A-D, I can't recall, but it's Cadwalder.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in charge of exterior styling for Chrysler at this time.
Where were the offices located?
The offices were in Highland Park, three long blocks east of Woodward. I'm trying to remember the name of the street. The present Chrysler Design Center is right there, but these were in the old engineering building up on the sixth floor. Henry King had interiors, but I strictly worked on the exteriors.
With Mr. Cadwalder.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm reaching a point where I may say something about people that they may not like. Cadwalder had, I believe, married the daughter of someone who was important at Chrysler.
Mm-hmm.
But he had been given a job. This is by hearsay before I knew him. Of running a drafting office, and I believe he was given the assignment to do the surface development of the Chrysler airflows, which, as you know, were pretty successful.
Mm-hmm.
And
one of the first to use the then fairly new technique of aerodynamic styling.
Oh, very much so. Bob was not a stylist in the sense that Buzz Grissinger and myself and other people are. He really couldn't draw. He was I don't think he originally was a draftsman. He was a man with a lot of drive, very very tall fellow. He knew what he wanted, and he was particularly interested in pleasing his bosses, and I guess there's nothing wrong with that. But as a younger man, why, a purist in those days, that rather got me. Bob hired me, and he expected me, apparently, to make nice illustrations of his designs. And it was rather a joke amongst the stylists in that room that he only had about two designs in mind, and he would sit down at our desk and sketch these over and over again for us to make pretty illustrations of. Bob also ran the clay modeling studio, part of the exterior. This was a separate room. He had a man who, I'll call him a security man. And there was a sort of a little lobby that separated the exterior studio from the clay modeling studio. Bob kept us out of the clay modeling studio. He wanted to direct the modeling and didn't want interference from us. The security man had a buzzer to press that allowed us to move in and out of the room. No one could come in our room, and this is the exterior design room, and we'd spend all day in there with our own designs going no place. In fact, we would argue with each other about wall space. We wanted to put our renderings up, and we finally evolved a system where each man had so many spaces on the wall, and that was it. Bob would come in, and he'd get somebody to move over a little bit and sit on their stool, and usually we'd have a roll of paper, sketch paper. It might have been 16 or 18 inches high, mm-hmm. and Bob had big hands, he's a big man. He'd grab a pencil and start sketching his idea, what he wanted. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily his idea, but and he'd do variations of this over and over again while this paper rolled up on the floor. Mm-hmm. And then when he left, a designer usually would hustle over and say, "How many inches did you collect that time?" And I think I had the record for a while of over 4 feet or something like that. But this is, you know, the way things can go. But I started doing my own renderings. I had the habit from having worked at General Motors. I'd start them at home. Mm-hmm. And since there were no decent eating places nearby, I would continue them during lunchtime. They were automobile renderings, but they, instead of being done the quick way on my Tandy's paper, I used illustration board, and I really was doing a job of illustration. I would never let Bob see those because he would feel I was wasting time. Well, he had instructions, so far as I know, or at least we did, to only do an automobile and not to spend much time on it. No backgrounds, nothing like that. And I was doing backgrounds. I was putting aircraft in the backgrounds. I was putting pretty girls in front of them and so forth. But they strictly were done during lunchtime or after work when you wait for traffic to clear. You know, sometimes most of us didn't care to go down there and join the mob right away. And I would tuck those away. One day we were going to have a visit from the man who was really running the company then. I'm trying to remember whether it was Breer. There was a triumvirate. Breer, Skelton, and someone
Zeter.
Else. Zeter. Zeter was the strong man. Mm-hmm. It was not Breer. It was Zeter.
Fred.
Yeah. It was Fred Zeter, and he was going to come in the studio.
Z-E-D-E-R.
Right. A very dignified man, an ex-engineer, I think, or executive engineer for Chrysler himself, white-haired, a little bit portly. He was going to come in. Now, the assistant head of the studio was Herb Weisinger, who has been gone for some time now.
How would you spell that?
Weisinger. Herb was a very kindly fellow. He had a lot of trouble running things for Bob with designers like us who were anxious to go ahead. Herb came around and wanted me to put these illustrations up, and I absolutely refused. I didn't want to be fired.
Is he?
Oh, obviously, yeah. He knew I was doing them and so forth. And he had his way. He put them up, and finally the big man came in, and one of these was in a prominent place right near the door. I have a photograph of it with me. This particular rendering, incidentally, was larger than the standard size. It was a good size sheet of illustration board, and it violated some of our bylaws. It had a girl between the viewer and the car, and she was stretching in a yawn, and you could see through her clothing somewhat, not the car particularly. And another girl leaning over the back, putting something in the trunk, and there were distracting aircraft and other images, including a second rear view of the same design in the background. And we were not supposed to waste time on things like that.
But the design itself was rather futuristic.
Yeah, it was. The design itself was my own design, and it was futuristic.
And can you explain very quickly how it differed from current models?
Well, it differed all over. But the point is that when Zeter walked in, he walked about 10 feet into the studio and stopped. He took his glasses off and got another pair of glasses out and put them on and proceeded to study this. Then he walked around, and there were a few others that Herb had me put up that he proceeded to look at. And then they left. And I, meantime, was thinking, well, I'm going to get fired. Well, that particular design that I first showed you ended up being the, at least its front end, ended up being the 41 Chrysler.
Really?
Yeah. He said, I want that design. And it sort of broke through the barrier we had mm-hmm. from before. I have a little bit more of a story to tell about these, but later on.
The barrier being?
Of not having our designs reach the people who would accept them.
Okay. It would have to filter upward through bureaucracy of
well, it wasn't. It wasn't. Now, usually in Ford and in General Motors, and I'm sure it's been that way at Chrysler, why they filter up through a, various committees and their meetings. In this instance, it was not. Only what Bob wanted to have seen was seen. He had a small staff. We worked on all four.
This was the exterior staff.
Cars. It was the exterior. And he therefore had a pretty good budget. We were paid more than the General Motors stylists and the Ford. It was a good paying job, and he had good men there. But they weren't accomplishing anything. They were completely shut off. I did hood ornaments with, I would design tail lamps or hood ornaments, or later some facelifts. I was drawing the girly hood ornaments we had, and the rams leaping off the hood and things like that. But
what was the Chrysler hood ornament at this time? Did they have a separate one for each car line?
Yes, and it might change from year to year too.
There's no consistency.
I don't remember that we had any particular emblem the way they do now.
Yes.
But that was an interesting story, and I'll continue it later with Raymond Loewy, same pictures.
Of interest at this point would be for you to describe the reason why the executive engineer was passing on design proposals.
That of course has been a big story with almost all the automobile companies, in that engineering ran styling in the old days. It was engineering's job to design the cars,
mm-hmm.
and the outer surfaces were part of their domain.
Mm-hmm.
It took years to break away from this because the engineers often were sympathetic with engineering but not with design appearance.
So design was in a relatively dark age at this point, because you were having body engineer types passing on the...
Oh, very definitely.
On the design.
And in fact, Cadwalader himself was an engineer.
I see.
And it was, I think, difficult for him to visualize some of the wilder things we wanted to do. Do you want to take another break? Can you run me in the last half an inch of that, please? Yeah. For example, all stylists wanted to make their cars lower and the front ends lower. This was an ongoing battle with engineers at the time. For example, most of us wanted to make our hoods go lower because we ended up with a lower front end shape. And to us, the lower and wider it was, why, the better it would look. It would look less top-heavy. Engineers wanted to put the radiator where they wanted to put it. And they wanted to put caps on top of the radiator, and they wanted, say, 2.5 or 3 inches clearance over that for the hood. So we ended up with a high hood. They wanted high seats. They wanted lots of headroom. We used to counter that argument with the fact that if they make the cars lower, they would actually use less sheet metal. If you were to stretch a tape measure from the bottom of a car up over the top and down the other side, you would find yourself using less sheet metal. But it took us many years to get the cars lower. We felt that helped streamline them, and in those days, streamlining was important, I think more or less as an advertising word, although it has become very important in the last few years because of fuel economy. But the stylist and the engineer fought that battle quite a bit, and we had other battles too. It was.
Could you elaborate on that concept of streamlining in 1940? You say that was simply a buzzword for the advertising people, something like the forward look or something like that? Or
I think it was. Norman Bel Geddes, for example, had made the word streamlining important. In fact, I noticed in one of those paragraphs I did not read that he apparently invented the word streamlining, or at least made it popular.
Uh-huh.
Many of his earlier transportation designs were very streamlined. You know, they had rounded, easy to flow over shapes.
This was an early aerodynamic concept.
Yeah. The Chrysler airflow shape to us was streamlined in one direction only. From the front view, it was not well rounded. It didn't have a lot of what we call tumble home.
Which is?
But tumble home is a word that is derived from the marine architect's world. It has to do with the slope of the sides of the hull. We use it upside down in automobiles. Again, that was another battle, but the I think perhaps the I can't think of the name of the car that was a little better streamlined than the Chrysler thing. But at Chrysler, I was very interested to find that on a second floor over one of their experimental garages, they had, 5, 6, maybe 8 small handmade airflow cars. They were experimental models. Chrysler, I think, was big on trying engineering innovations. In fact, that's one thing I liked about Chrysler. I thought they had the best engineers in the industry in that time, before World War II.
Interestingly, though, the airflow in both the Chrysler and Plymouth versions had died a rather ignominious death by this time. But,
right.
But even so, even though the public didn't accept it, the Chrysler engineers still felt it was a landmark.
Oh, they did. And I remember when I first saw an airflow in a showroom in New York City, I was very impressed with their interior as much as anything, because it was so wide.
Mm-hmm.
And they had modern furniture with metallic trim on it, which was also new. Mm-hmm. But these these handmade cars that I started to mention, were made before my time with Chrysler. They were mostly small cars, smaller than the, I think, any of the cars on our streets at that time, except perhaps some a few imported cars.
Did they have scale versions of the?
They weren't scale. They were cars with seats in them and working cars. They had engines. And what fascinated me were the engines. Now, one car had a radial engine in it up front. In fact, I think there were two of them. One was air-cooled and the other was water-cooled. They had different engine configurations and different what we call packages. That is, the engine might be one place and the seats a different place and so forth. They were just up in a big, dark, second-story garage room just on a concrete floor. And I have often wondered what has ever happened to those, because they were just, you know, they were fascinating. They were done by engineers who wanted to do advanced things. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great. I was very impressed.
They were the complete automobiles down to the last detail.
Yeah, and they were new concepts, and I have the feeling that somebody squelched them all, because no one would mention them.
They weren't in any way clay or fiberglass.
No, they were automobiles.
Automobiles,
Now, whether how they worked, I don't know. They just stood there under wraps in a dark room.
Were they a drivable vehicle?
As far as I know, they were, unless I was fooled. But
and the engines worked.
As far as I know, they were.
What building was this in again?
It was some building, I think, to the north of and in back of the Chrysler Engineering Building.
Mm-hmm. Does the Chrysler Engineering Building still exist, or have they replaced it?
I think it does. I think it's been modernized or something. Uh-huh. It's just to the north of the Design Center.
Today?
Today's modern mm-hmm. Design Center, which stands on the site of the old employment building, mm-hmm. where the doctors gave you examinations.
It's now the Walter P. Chrysler building.
Is that the name of it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I've got an interesting story to tell. To me, it's interesting.
Yes.
About that building. I'm skipping years ahead. At the time, I was working for Ford, and I was swimming with a small group of people at the Northwest YMCA in the morning for exercise. And a man there was the vice president, as far as I'm concerned, the fellow who ran one of the large building companies in the Detroit area. And we used to have a little snack, you know, coffee and orange juice, after we swam together in one of the rooms in the Y. And one day he asked me to do him a favor. And I'm working for Ford, but I ended up in this Chrysler building, which the contractor had not yet turned over to his customer. The builder had a problem with the bridge tracks. I don't know if you know what a bridge is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, the bridge that passes over the clay model and from which measurements are taken. And it concerned the accuracy of the tracks. At the time, I think I had told him of the trouble we had with some tracks in the new design building in England when I was there. And so he wanted some outsider's opinion, an outsider who knew something about it, to use in an argument against Chrysler Engineering, an argument I shouldn't have been in. They wanted a much smaller tolerance than he could get. But anyway, I went down there with him. And I think this was in the basement. It was a lower floor, certainly. And
of the engineering building?
Of the design building. They had stainless steel wires stretched from one end of the building to the other, very taut. And they had some sort of a handmade machine on wheels that would go along there and check everything. It had all the little arms coming out of it and so forth. And I kept telling him, I shouldn't be here and you shouldn't be quoting me on anything. And I don't remember now what we said, but some years later I would kid a good friend of mine who was fairly high in Chrysler styling about having been in that building before he was. And I was able to describe it to him, you know, down to details. But that's just to one side. let's see, we're, I'm a Chrysler, and...
What are your principal duties at this point?
Well, I was a designer, a stylist on the board, and I got to doing a little supervising of clay modeling. I guess I was going to say that I think after that incident with Zeter looking at that rendering and picking it, that the designers in the room started to have a little more freedom. And I think Bob realized...
Cadwalder
realized that he could get credit for having more designs and better designs if he utilized his people. But now I'm putting words in his mouth. I really shouldn't. Well, let's see. What happened?
So at this point, until that happened, you had been largely trim and color people, pretty much.
That's right, yeah. No, I didn't accomplish too much at Chrysler. I did the 41 Plymouth front end.
Did you?
And
the final?
Yeah, the final,
mm-hmm.
Which was a facelift again,
mm-hmm.
because we were getting into the war then.
Of course, you had done the 41 Chrysler.
Yeah, I didn't really supervise that, but the design that Zeter saw was adapted by Bob
mm-hmm.
To a facelift.
Mm-hmm.
It had the horizontal bands around it.
Uh-huh.
The Plymouth, I always felt, was more mine, but
mm-hmm.
still in all, it was just a facelift. Plus designing other parts, like...
What particularly distinguished that 41 Plymouth front end that you remember so well?
It had a little fan shape. It had a sheet metal split, sort of a prow that,
mm-hmm.
that came
right.
out. Had a
very common in those days.
Yeah, that's right, very common in those days. And it had some little bands on it and
mm-hmm.
That let in a little extra air to the high radiator. And,
chrome or steel bands?
Yeah, they were chrome. And then it had a sort of a fan-shaped grill on each side of this vertical cleft.
Very distinctive.
Well, I thought it came out rather nice for what it was. In fact, it resembled one of the renderings I first sent out to Bob Cadwalder.
Uh-huh.
Something like what I had in mind then. We were getting into the war by this time. I remember seeing P-39 fighter planes flying over the studio, waggling their wings on their way out to the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Monday after Pearl Harbor. We were put to coming up with ideas for and illustrating different variations of things Chrysler might make for the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
Armored trucks with guns coming out of them and some pretty tricky things. I had to make a, I'm good at perspective, and I had to make a perspective study of proposed tank that would use five Chrysler engines arranged around a circle to drive a tank.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember having trouble. It had an exhaust collector ring, and this passed right through the rear axle. And the engineers didn't believe that a mere artist was, they thought he was doing something wrong, and it turned out that indeed two different departments had utilized the same space, which is rather common under an automobile hood, you know, that the departments get together and have an argument about who's going to occupy those cubic inches.
Mm-hmm.
But sometime before that, I was, I forgot to mention, when I was young, I had gained a competitive scholarship at Columbia University in aeronautical design. And I was, you know, really in love with airplanes more than automobiles. The depression hit and the endowments failed. And I ended up digging sewer ditches for a couple of years. At any rate, I had started to go to night school in Detroit, and I was taking aeronautical technical subjects. And one of my instructors in aircraft tool design, that would be at Wayne State University, wanted me to come to work for him in the aircraft industry. And I did so. I went to work for him. We were not, when I agreed to go, we weren't in the war yet. I'm trying to remember when I went. Yeah, here we are. when I, yeah, I finally went to work for this man. He,
Late 41, probably.
Yeah, he convinced me that, well, I was studying with him, but I started in 42.
Oh.
As I say, I was still at Chrysler when Pearl Harbor hit us.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to work for him. I had a very good knowledge of structure.
Do you remember his name?
I'll try to think of it. He was primarily a glider designer, which means he was an aerodynamist rather than a structures man.
Mm-hmm.
But he appreciated my ability to make quick perspective drawings. And also he
had a rare talent in design.
Well, yeah, with mechanical subjects. Mm-hmm. And it appears that one of the courses I took at Pratt came in quite well here, because I had a good knowledge of architectural construction, including the geometry and mathematics of it. And I'd never really used it since then, but most aeronautical engineers in those days, and this was, you know, really still early days, were aerodynamists more than structural people. And there just weren't any floating around who were good at structures.
Exteriors.
Yeah. Well, they were interested in wind tunnels and the wing sections and
yes.
the lift and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I guess the structure inside was rather boring. And of course, they had structural experts in the aircraft industry,
mm-hmm.
but they were all out on the West Coast
uh-huh.
and probably quite well paid and secure in their jobs. Well, I ended up, I spent the war coming up with repairs for aircraft that were damaged.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite fascinating to me. The hours were terribly long. We worked many shifts. I tried to get out of it and get into more direct war effort. In fact, I had myself put on trial with the, I think they call it the War Manpower Board in Detroit. And I was told to stay right where I was. But
So you were deferred?
Yeah. Oh, and the reason why I went into this was that when Mrs. Roosevelt reached in the barrel and picked out numbers, I got the second. I had the second number. My number was the second one she picked up, and we were expecting. And I went into the war effort, not at the time believing we'd really, you know, get into it. That's I started going into that. So anyway, I spent the war still working on transportation. It comes in with your. With your subject, but it was transporting bombs, or, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it gave me a terrific insight into the problems that they have in aircraft.
Uh-huh.
For example, let's say the armed forces inspectors would not release to us engineers on the floor their stress books, supposed to be highly secret. So when something was damaged, I and other people like myself would have to work out why the structure that was damaged was a certain way and come up with a way of repairing it. It had to be 50% stronger than the original. But I spent the war doing
that. You've not mentioned what company this was.
Oh, it was Briggs. I'm sorry.
Briggs and one of their war contracts was to salvage damaged aircraft.
Well, no, they were manufacturing as subcontractors quite a few different aircraft.
Oh, I see.
They did different parts of Douglas planes, Boeing planes,
uh-huh.
And, oh, I don't know, three or four others.
Uh-huh.
And we got to be experts on those structures. We also got to be experts on relations between production people who didn't apparently give a damn about their quality. They just wanted to get the numbers out.
Mm-hmm.
And the customers and Army-Navy inspectors.
What was the your title, salvage engineer, senior aircraft salvage engineer?
Yeah.
How did that work?
Well, that's what we were doing. We were salvaging any damage, and that was the
In the production cycle.
Yeah, in the production cycle.
Not airplanes that had been damaged in the war, obviously not yet.
No, no.
I see.
We had an opportunity to get a look at some of those and suggest repairs.
Uh-huh.
But we were pretty far from the battlefield. We, of course, what we did affected the how these airplanes operated too. For example, one person made a mistake, not working in my field, but where the trailing edge of an aileron was crimped into a V shape. This is a piece of aluminum. He forgot to specify that this be done when the metal was soft and it'd be heat treated later. And these things started splitting apart in the air. And he found himself in trouble with the FBI many months later.
Yes. They were checking back to see why that happened.
Yeah. You know, them it looked like sabotage, or it could be. So they started delving into it.
Yes.
It was a serious mistake, but it wasn't done on purpose.
I noticed one of your early sketches was one of the Lockheed Lightning. Is that the P-38 that you mentioned?
Oh, that was my own design.
Yeah.
In there. Yeah, those aircraft in the background behind the Chrysler car designs were just my interest in aircraft coming out.
But one of them is very much like the P-38.
Oh, I imagine today there will be a resemblance. For example, a gull wing will look like a...
But the twin booms are quite unique.
Yeah. It was probably a somewhat different configuration, but it might have been my idea of how to improve a P-38. I don't remember. But they were, it was fun doing them.
Did you enjoy this work? This was about 4 years, or three or four
years.
Yeah,
it was very tiring, and it was a setback to...